This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Trumpeter Lee Morgan was a jazz prodigy who quickly became a cornerstone at Blue Note Records. But Lee Morgan had troubles in his personal life. Drugs, addiction destroyed his career until he met Helen Morgan. She turned it all around, and then she shot him dead when he was 33. The checkered career of Lee Morgan and the story of the woman who killed him came to light recently with the publication of a new book. Wilmington native and jazz writer Larry Thomas is the author of The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan. Larry met Helen Morgan in the mid-1990s and talked to her about it. In fact, he interviewed her about a month before she died. Larry Thomas joins us now on The State of Things to tell us more about the lady who shot Lee Morgan. Welcome back, Larry. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here, man.
Tell us more about Lee Morgan. I mean, he played with some of the greats,
right? Oh, he's extremely high cat. He started very early, as you just mentioned, when he was a teenager. I think his first gig was with Dizzy Gillespie. Oh. He was definitely a child prodigy here. He'd been the hottest thing in Philadelphia, eventually got to New York, played with Blakey, recorded with Blue Note several times. Fantastic talent, just overwhelming talent.
And then it just he fell on hard times, right?
Well, you know, Art Blakey had a reputation for, Art Blakey was a heroin addict. I mean, that was common knowledge. Mm. And so Art Blakey had a habit of turning anybody who was in his band on. And Helen told me an interesting thing. She told me a lot of interesting items. She said, Buhana, that was Art's nickname. He was actually Muslim. Buhana turned Lee on. And Lee said, well, how long does the high last? And she said, Art Blakey said, forever.
Yeah. So he had it. Well, now tell us about Helen. First of all, tell us about her relationship. I want to find out how you met her, but tell us about her relationship then with Lee Morgan.
Well, she said she met him one cold night. One of the chapters in my book is One Cold Night in February. She met him through Benny Green, who was a trombone player. She had a habit of going with a lot of jazz musicians. She went to New York in 1945, and she would always go uptown to these after-hour spots, and she met Benny Green. And she lived in an apartment where the jazz musicians would always come after the gigs. She lived downtown, actually, where they would come after the gig. And she met Lee Morgan through Benny Powell, who brought him by her apartment, because she would feed the musicians when they would come by. And she said her heart just went out to this little young musician. She called him a little boy, actually.
She was older than him, right?
Much older, about 14 years older than he was. And she said he didn't have an overcoat on, because she said it was about 10, 20 degrees on the outside, and the snow was on the ground. And she said, where's your overcoat? You don't have an overcoat. He said it was in the pawn shop. She said, well, where's your horn? She said, it's in the pawn shop, too. So she said, well, we're going to go get your items. She said, how can you perform? It's like a carpenter without a hammer. You can't perform unless you have an axe. So she said, I'm going to go to the pawn shop and get your stuff out of the pawn shop. And he said, you're going to get my stuff out of the pawn shop? It was almost like he couldn't believe it. Right. So once she got it out of the pawn shop, got his axe and his coat out of the pawn shop, she said she took over total control of Morgan's life. That's a quote. And it blew my mind when she said, I said, wow. She took over total control of his life. And at that point, she became his manager and his lady. I mean, you know, she considered him her husband.
But it really turned things around. I mean, he got heroin, right? Ended his addiction, but only temporarily.
Yeah, I mean, it's a temporary thing, you know, especially if you're in New York, because you're surrounded by it, man. It's very difficult. One of the things that happens is when heroin addicts, and I can speak for personal experience, when heroin addicts kick, they get on methadone, right? Mm-hmm. And I think he was on methadone. And what really happens is that some of them can't stop, you know, using.
You're using something.
It's a needle freak. It's really, you just like to put a needle in your arm.
Well, and I guess the thing about methadone, too, it sort of brings the price down. I mean, eventually, you know,
to a certain extent, but you still want to get high.
Yeah, right.
And so at that particular time, there was nothing on the street, so there was no heroin on the street, and he was shooting a whole lot of cocaine, and she would come in sometimes and see him shooting cocaine, you know. So he was still using.
Right.
But he was clean, cleaner than he'd ever been, because he was like a dirty junkie walking the streets, had nowhere to stay and everything.
So his cocaine use, his return to drugs, might have been disturbing, but he was also seeing other women.
Right. Most definitely.
And that.
Yeah, that was the kicker. That really messed her up. You know?
So tell us now, and then what happened?
Well, he started leaving home and staying away for long, long times. I mean, he would come in once in a while, and she was at home all by herself. But they were doing really well. I mean, if anybody knows anything about New York, he was living up in the Bronx on the Grand Concourse. And at that particular time, that was really a ritzy place to live, you know. And for all purposes, she was considered his lady, because every time you saw Lee, you saw her, you know. But he started cutting out real hard on her. I mean, he would be seen in public with another girl, and a younger girl who had been after him, according to Helen, for a long time. And so for some reason, he bought her a pistol because, you know, she was at home alone. And he was wondering about something happening to her at home. So she said this to me. She said she didn't know what possessed her. I mean, that was a serious term, you know, possessed her to go to Slugs that night. You know, she said, I'm going to, she told a guy who was staying with her, some gay guy who was staying with her. She said, well, I'm going to go to the Vanguard and see Freddie Hubbard. Then I'm going to go to Slugs, you know, to see Lee.
To see Lee. He was playing at Slugs.
She said, well, don't go. You know, he told her not to go. And she said, for some reason, she put the gun in her bag. She said, for something possessed her to do that. And she went downtown, went to Vanguard, and then went to Slugs. And she waited for intermission. She was sitting at the table with a guy named Paul West, who was a bass player who knew Lee, you know. And I got a chance to talk to Paul West later on. He was sitting at the table with her when she got up. And for some reason, she got in some kind of confrontation. She said she went over to the table.
And you interviewed her, so you had,
yes,
had a chance to talk with her.
Right.
So let's get a clip now. We'll talk and we'll hear what she told you happened next.
Right.
And I said, oh, my God. You know, I just threw the gun, you know. I don't know who got the gun. I don't know what happened to the gun. The police asked me who had the gun. I said, I don't know. I just threw the gun on the bar. Mm. And I ran over there, and I was so sorry. Oh, you know. And he said to me, he said, Helen, I know you didn't mean to do this.
And he said that?
Uh-huh. He said, I know you didn't mean. He said, I'm sorry, too.
He said he's sorry.
Uh-huh. He said, I'm sorry, too. And the rest of the musicians, the rest of the group, told me, he said that he had been saying, Helen gonna hurt me. Because I'm not doing her right.
That's Helen Morgan, the lady who shot Lee Morgan, and she told her story to Larry Thomas, who wrote the book. So everybody knew this was coming, I guess, huh?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Because he was so flagrant with it, you know, and he was a really brassy guy, you know. A lot of cats didn't dig him, you know. A lot of people didn't like him because he was very arrogant. Mm-hmm. That seems to be the nature of trumpet players. You know, they got this.
That's a big solo instrument. They get a lot of attention.
I guess it's the element of this brass coming against your lips, you know. But no one has this interview. It's an exclusive interview.
So tell us how you met Helen and got this story.
I met her. I was teaching at Shaw Cape, which is an alternative program for adults who it meets at night in Wilmington. I was hosting a jazz program. And as a way of introduction, I would introduce myself to the class as a jazz host. I was doing like a five-nighter at WHQR, which is the public radio station in Wilmington. Mm. And she said, oh, I love jazz. And I get that all the time. And I said, well, I'm expecting. I said, well, who? Yeah, Kenny G, I guess, you know. And so she said, my husband was a jazz musician, and her last name was Morgan. And I said, well, what was your husband's name? So she says, Lee. I said, Lee Morgan, the trumpet player? She said, yes. I said, oh, I sure would like to interview you one day. She said, I'll think about it. That was in 1990. It wasn't until 1996. I think she knew she was about to pass. And she's never told the story to anybody. And the records, the police records, have disappeared. So she, there's no.
So at this time, did you know that Lee Morgan had been shot dead by his wife?
I mean, anybody who was into jazz, anybody who's into jazz knows that.
So you know you. So at that moment, you knew you were talking to the woman who killed.
Yeah, I said, well, it was because I'm a historian.
Right.
I knew that, it would be historic. It would be a really historical significance to do that because all the accounts that I've heard were accounts from somebody else, not her, you know. And what happened after that is I wrote an article called The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan, and copyrighted in 2007. It went from here to Indonesia, man. It's been translated into French, Spanish, German, Italian. And this guy in Sweden picked it up, and he's going to come out with a movie. I'm going to be in the movie, believe it or not. You know,
we got to come back when that happens.
Yeah, by all
means. So it's incredible. So the story does get out. She decides finally to tell it, and there is a story to tell because she had really concealed all of this. She moved to Wilmington. So tell us about first. Tell us what happened to her in the aftermath of that shooting, and then how she got to Wilmington.
Interesting. She got arrested February 19, 1972. She stayed in Rikers Island for 2 or 3 months because I guess they were trying to get the bail money because I think a bail money was $5 million or something, $1 million. So they tried to get her. Once they got her out, she never went back to jail. It was strange, man. The lawyer, it's interesting that the lawyer she got, she started dating the lawyer, went on a date with her. She had two children at 13 and 14.
She was 13 when she and 14 when she had the children.
Yes, wow. And she had moved to New York in 45 at 19 years old. But the point I want to make is that she never went back to jail. The lawyer took her to a party at a country club. They met the judge. And the next year, they just threw the case out. The case was over with. She never did too much time at all.
And you're saying even the records of that trial.
It's gone. Yeah. A guy who wrote a book, Jeffrey McMillan wrote a book called Delightful Lee. And he used excerpts of my interview in the book. And he tried to retrieve the police records. And they're gone.
What was it like talking with her? Because you said it was at the end of her life. You had a feeling she wanted to get all this out. And I missed a point here. When she moved to Wilmington then, she kind of left her past behind. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, she became a church lady. She became this really staunch church lady. She went to church almost every Sunday. Her mother was involved in the church. No one had an inkling of an idea that she was Helen. I mean, who knows who Lee Morgan is?
Yeah.
You know, in Wilmington, I bet it's 10 people. There were less than that who knew that she killed him. She became this church-going lady, and it was just by chance that I met her, and she trusted me because she knew I knew what the deal was in terms of the jazz world. The jazz people hate her vehemently.
Why?
Because she killed their fellow jazz musician. Yeah. You know, it's like a guy carrying a letter carrier, and she killed him on the gig. It's like a guy carrying mail, right? And his wife shows up while he's delivering mail and kills him. You know, and they're at peace when they're on the stage. They hate her. A lot of them don't dig me. I've had serious problems.
I thought maybe she was telling tales, too, about other people on the circuit. But
well, she did.
Yeah.
She talked about Miles like a dog.
Didn't like Miles.
At all.
She didn't.
I don't think Miles liked anybody.
Tell us more about her children, then.
She didn't meet her children. They didn't meet her until they were in their 20s. She abandoned them. She had a first one at 13 and the other one at 14. And she left them on a farm in Shalote. Shalote is a place that's located across the Cape Fear River from Wilmington. She left them with her grandparents. They thought that she was their cousin or something because she was, you know, she wasn't that much older than either one of them.
So how did they find out about her? Was it through your story, or did they know about that before?
Some kind of way they found out about it, and they actually were living with her in New York for a minute or two. And I was actually able to find both of them. And the guy who's doing the movie, Casper Collin, he did the movie called My Name is Albert Eiler, a Swedish guy. Very sweet and very naive.
Well, this is a heck of a story. So she's telling the story at the end, and it is kind of interesting. I mean, I don't know, you can over-psychologize, I guess, but you know, here's a woman who abandoned her children, who is much older than Lee Morgan, who really took them in, got them a coat, got them a gig. And,
that's right. She cleaned them up.
And then cleaned them out, I guess. That was it, or did away with them.
Right.
So what? How did she feel about it at the end? She told the story where she looked back on it when she reflected on it.
Well, you know, Frank, it was very interesting. The first thing she said to me was, "I don't know if I loved him or I thought of him as my possession." Mm. And she said a lot of things that were really, you know, that really set me back. You know, when she said that, I said, "Well, did you? Did you love him?" She said, "I don't know." And I thought to myself, I said, "Well, after all these years, she hadn't figured out yet if she loved him or not." So,
whatever happened to the lawyer and the judge? She just left them too, I guess. They never.
She was
not part of the picture.
She was definitely an interesting lady. I mean, she had this thing about her that was, you know, that you could tell she had this streetwise thing about her, and she was very astute.
Yeah.
She wasn't like a really academically inclined person, but she had a. You could tell she had a lot of street sense. She'd been around the block a couple of times, as they say.
It's a great story, Larry. We can't wait for the movie. Thanks so much for being
on the program. Thank you, man, for having me here.
Larry Thomas, veteran jazz writer. He is a radio DJ. He's based in Chapel Hill. And he's going to be talking about his book, The Lady Who Shot Lee Morgan, at the local kickoff event for Jazz Appreciation Month. Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. You can get more information at our website, stateofthings.org. It's a program that's produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley's our technical director, and Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stay Show.